Welcome back to the Egg Aviator Podcast, folks. I'm sorry it's been a while. You've heard from me again. It's been a busy winter. I was able to record four podcasts while I was at the NAAA convention in Savannah, Georgia, the first week of December. It's been a pretty busy winter so far. It seems to snow 2 days a week, and the wind blows the other days. So been busy moving snow, not just at my house, but also in town for some businesses, and I've just have not had much time to sit down and edit a podcast, but finally got one done this week, and like I said, I got a couple more coming down the pipe as time rolls on here, so sorry for the delay, but we're finally back. This first episode is called the Mentorship Roundtable. If you are a part of the Rookie Egg Pilot Facebook page, these are some familiar faces and voices you may have heard already before. Some of these guests are returners to the Egg Aviator podcast. We've got Mike Rutledge and Matt Peed with us. And we added George Parker as well, too. He was at the convention, and if you're part of the Rookie Egg Pilot page, you know George very well. As you can tell by the title, Mentorship Roundtable, we talked a lot about mentorship. Mentoring is something that all of these gentlemen take very seriously, and they're, you know, actively doing in their operations and have been actively doing for some time now. They've got it very well thought out, and they just share their thoughts and opinions on mentorship in today's age in egg aviation, where the world of piston airplanes is kind of fading away and turbine airplanes is really kind of all we've got. And we talk a lot about what egg pilots getting in the industry should do if they want to get a job, the expectations they should have, the expectations that their employer's going to have. So if you're somebody who's looking to get into the industry, or you've had a loading job for a year or two and you're kind of wondering what's going on, what's my next step, there might be some good advice in this episode for you. I think also if you're an operator who is trying to figure out what they want to do to mentor their new pilot, if, you know, should I buy a piston airplane? Is it worth it? Should I just take the time and put them in a turbine that I already own? There's some great discussion about that in this episode, and wide variety of audience is going to be able to take something away from this episode. I really enjoyed recording it. I hope you guys enjoy listening to it. I do apologize ahead of time. I could not hear these sound issues while I was recording, and I could not see them on my soundboard. I have these dynamic mics, and basically how these microphones work is they are just like the mic on your headset or your helmet while you're flying. The mic does not key up until you start talking, and that's exactly how these podcast mics work. And apparently, the guests were sitting too far away from the microphones. In my past experience, as far as I was concerned, I never saw anything that bothered me. They were close enough to the mic, and I could see their volume and their mics keying up on my soundboard. Comes time to edit, it does not sound that great. There's a few spots where the audio dips up and down. I promise I did my absolute best to try and fix it and make it even. It's not perfect, and I really, really apologize for that. I'll figure out what the problem is. I really think it has to do with how close they were to the mic. But I will make sure in the future that we don't have that problem anymore. So, I've held you guys up enough. The Egg Aviator Podcast spools up now. And, of course, we can't forget to thank our sponsor, American Designs. Travis Sum over at American Designs is an egg pilot that is building parts for egg pilots, just like his aluminum air tractor step extensions, mirrors, sun visor, and new, the Hellchock helmet mount. I got a cool video that I'm going to share with you guys eventually about the Hellchock helmet mount system. Travis also is working on building the one-stop shop for egg aviation parts over at his website, americandesigns.com. You can check out all his cool products at americandesigns.com. That's spelled Alpha Mike Bravo, E-R-I-C-A-N, designs.com. And if you're interested in checking out the new Hellchock helmet mount, make sure to run over to hellchock.com. That's spelled Hilo Echo Lima, C-H-O-C-K.com. Thanks, Travis. And with that, let's just roll right into the discussion.
We'll maybe start with, I heard you talking earlier today on the boat about what a mentor should look for. You know, what did you see in Forrest? You made it super simple, though. You just said somebody I can get along with.
Yeah, I think every operator or supervisor, boss, whatever, has a certain flavor of personality, and whatever that is, you want to build your team with people you like being around. Mm-hmm. I mean, the assumption is everybody has good work ethic, wants to fly and do a good job, but at the end of the day, the ability to work with people day in, day out under all the stresses that we do in ag aviation on hard days is almost more important than how much skill they have. Mm-hmm. If you like being with somebody, you know, and you enjoy working with them and they can handle the stress together and you're all productive, you can pretty much teach them anything that they need to know. Mm-hmm. But every team is different, so everyone's got a different flavor. Mm-hmm.
So, Matt, right now you're working with Marcus.
That's
you're
correct.
Helping. We kind of just started the conversation, but that's okay. That's good, Mike. I'll make it work. So you're breaking in Marcus right now, not particularly at your operation. Correct?
Yes, and yeah, my operation, and I say my operation, the farming operation that I work for, but I'm the guy, so I guess it is my operation. Mm-hmm.
What characteristics did Marcus show that made you want to be a good mentor to him? Well, obviously you want to be a good mentor all the time, but what about Marcus made him a good candidate?
Well, Marcus said it best, I think. He said, I mean, he was seeking a mentor. Mm-hmm. So it's a relationship, and that implies there's give and take, and there's a reciprocity there between individuals. But Marcus showed, I mean, he's got an incredible amount of drive. Mm-hmm. He wants to improve himself. Mm-hmm. He's definitely got skin in the game, and he's willing to think outside the box in terms of how he goes about accomplishing what he needs to accomplish in terms of ratings or what have you. Mm-hmm. He's willing to get out there and work and figure out a way to make it happen. Mm-hmm. So he showed a lot of resourcefulness. I mean, I made a comment yesterday evening's Compass Rose session about, you know, there's a lot of different ways to skin the cat.
Yeah.
And he was able to purchase, find an airplane, a J3 Cub, to build time in. So, you know, he's going to sell that thing here pretty soon and recoup a lot of his money. Mm-hmm. And he's accomplished what others have maybe spent $60,000 on. He's done for way less than that.
Right.
So,
George, you have recently broken in a gentleman into a turbine. What did he present to you that made you feel like he was a good candidate for the position you've put him in?
Well, kind of, I guess, unlike these other guys, I'm not nearly as worldly with my thought processes.
That's
when I'm
a
looking
lie.
For somebody That's a to lie. Mentor. That's
smarter than all of us. He's
and it's why I say they all have to load for a season. Because the first thing that you want people to do is to see what the business truly is. It cannot be a reflection of the brochure of what it is in your mind.
That's correct.
It has to be reality. And the only way to know what reality is to partake in it. And since you can't partake in it in the airplane because you're not properly qualified, the only way for you to partake in it is to be part of a ground crew. And so once you get past establishing what the reality of the business is to the potential person that's going to break into the business, then we're just simply looking for soft skills. Are they timely? Do they show up to work on time? Can they show up to work on time at 4:00 in the morning on the 23rd day straight on July 25th without any problems? Will they work a 10, 12, 14, 16, whatever hour day, and come back the following day still smiling? Because even though it's visualized by, I hear a lot of negative comments about, you know, somebody being the loader bitch or something like that, or I paid money to be a pilot and I'm not going to do this. And when people are working on the ground, sometimes they view it that the work in the airplane is different than the work they're partaking in on the ground. The reality is, although it may not be as dusty and they may not be lifting 50-pound bags or hopping wing, it's blue-collar aviation, and the work in the airplane is just as rigorous and just as tough, just as hot. You know, in fact, If a guy is on long turns, the loader may actually have an easier time of it because when they get done mixing the next load, they'll have 15 or 20 minutes to sit around. The whole time they're sitting around in the shade on their phone while they're on payroll, that pilot is out there ducking under power lines, trying not to spray kids on trampolines, pulling up over tree lines, and he's working. And if it's an afternoon of fertilizer, then if it's windy, then you're getting bumped on. You're just constantly in it for the entire afternoon of fertilizing. And so it's not any easier than the ground job. And so when you actually watch someone's performance in the ground position for the first season, it gives you an indication of who they really are, because everybody's cool in the first 2 weeks. Everybody's eager,
yep,
and 7 minutes early and polishing stuff with a handkerchief. Coffee's and yes, made sir, and the coffee's made.
Yep.
But on that 96th day on August 3rd, after you just got done taking the whipping that is July for most of us, you need to know what the guy is on that day. And the only way to see that is to have them do it, because everybody says they're really good. But nothing beats actual observation.
Yep.
And then the other thing it does is that it personally allows me to see what their personality is. Because I feel like when you're going to take on the responsibility of breaking someone in order to do this responsibly enough, because what you say or don't say can potentially be what leads them into a fatality. And if you have someone you're breaking in that ends up actually dying in the airplane, that's going to bother any of us. And no rookie ever really thinks about that. If one of us has to call your mother or your wife or your girlfriend and tell them that you just died in the airplane, that's on your shoulders forever. And so I think that reading a person, finding out how do they learn by example? Do you need to explain it to them a bunch? Do you think they might just not be appropriate for the position? I mean, ag flying is not for everybody, period, the end. And so once you get into observing what a person's personality truly is, then that helps me guide them. You know, one of my rookie break-ins is really type A. He's a super go-getter, and he does a wonderful job for me now. But one of the things we had to get in check was he was too much of a go-getter. So our saying with him was, we're not in a rush. I would always hand him a map, and I would say, we're not in a rush. And he would be switched over and running out to the airplane. I'd say, hurry up, but we're not in a rush. And so we said that over and over and over again to help kind of moderate him and slow him down. And now 6 years later, he is really at the peak of everything perfectly in my personal mind for working for me. We've moderated that rushing out because we all know that in aviation, rushing causes accidents. So that's another thing that I think rookies that are trying to avoid loading don't recognize. And maybe some mentors don't recognize that that's what the loading time can do.
Yeah.
But if you are a mentor and you consciously put your effort toward finding out how a person thinks, how a person moves, what their faults are, what their shortcomings are, then you can focus on those shortcomings and help make them a better rookie, which will eventually make them a better ag pilot. So to me, that is what the first season is really about. And I don't even ask them until September 16th of the first season, okay, now you've seen it. What do you really think about it? Do you still think you want to be an ag pilot? And then once they actually, if they say yes on September 16th and they're in a position to be broken in by me, then we start to move forward and discuss flying my airplanes or what I'm going to do for you and what order or what they have to do to put skin in the game. But initially in my place, you show up to load. We don't talk about flying any of my stuff. We don't even talk about flying. I want to know if you know how many ounces are in a gallon, what the square footage of an acre is, and how long a mile is in feet, and how many dry ounces are in a pound. That's what I want to know you know. And that's where we start.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, I think George nailed it. I think this podcast is a wrap. Like, done. Like, I think we're almost there. Yeah. Well, that's really good. So a very good point that George brought up is every operation or every mentor has a different flavor. But one point that he made of on, you know, the 45th day when your entire ground crew, to include pilots, everybody's tired, malnourished, chronic fatigue is set in, they're irritable. That is truly when you find out, and you know, you're not trying to haze them, but that's when you truly find out if you can continue to work
as a team. I am trying to haze them.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. You know, but that's when you find out the true personality. It's kind of like, you know, true personality comes out when everybody's at the bar. Same to be said when you're broken down physically and chronically fatigued.
That's right.
It's where you really find out who's on the team or who, honestly, some of your heavy pipe hitters that come in strong and saying, I'm the best, I'll do anything. Sometimes those are the ones that break the earliest, and, you know, they're just there for the shiny airplanes, and then they realize that this is a lot more physical than I thought it was, and, yep. You know, kind of like everybody, they say, you know, everybody wants to be a Navy SEAL when it's sunny and warm out. So it's definitely the same thing for guys wanting to be an egg. That's the dark underbelly that everyone, including pilots, have to deal with. And when everybody is short-tempered and tired, it takes a lot of maturity and a lot of restraint to not let loose on each other because everybody's feeling the same way. And that's when you find out, like I said, the guys you actually want to work with versus the ones who are just there to fly an airplane. And it's, you know, and it's, I think as mentors, sometimes we as a cohort have misrepresented loading as paying your dues. And that, and they use that a lot. And I kind of wince every time I hear somebody say, well, you know, you got to pay your dues. And that's a really bad, bad way to describe it because it sets about a certain mindset. And so guys go into it thinking about, oh, I just got to get through this season of loading and I can fly. And that's not the intent. I mean, you truly, as George indicated, you truly are learning your craft because most of that goes into the airplane and, you know, only 20% of actually being in the airplane is flying. So that is the core of what we do, the mixing and loading and handling the airplanes and taking care of the trucks and the equipment and being able to work under duress and physical discomfort. I mean, that is the core of what we do, and flying the airplane is just kind of one of the other jobs.
It's a team effort, and that's one thing. I share Mike's sentiment as far as that you hear is that loading or ground crew operations or whatnot are somehow subpar or whatever, and the deal is – It's a team effort. I could be the greatest aerial applicator of all time, but if the individual loading or makes a mistake, then I can screw up. I can do millions of dollars worth of damage depending on what crop I'm over. Or let's go to the office and the administrative. All this work has to be administrated. It has to be billed. The money has to be collected so that you can get paid. And that's what really is concerning to me. I hear so much about, well, let's go fly the nice, shiny, yellow airplane or whatever. And little is said about all of the support and all of the effort that it takes to keep that airplane in the air. So as I talk to individuals that are looking to get into this, or I'm talking to Marcus, I'm making sure I give him the full orbed, you know, this is what we're after here. And he understands that. He works on a farm, so he understands the – and he's loaded. He's run ground rigs and all the above. So he understands the process from the time you put the seed in the ground till, you know, you're picking the cotton or peanuts or what have you. Mm-hmm. So there needs to be more emphasis on this is a team effort.
Being a loader – is not just being a loader.
That's correct.
And like what George said about, I mean, knowing how many square feet are in an acre. I mean, this is all stuff that people should be learning at that loading stage. It's a period of growing. That knowledge that you should gain as a loader is going to be so valuable as a pilot. And it's just more painful to delay some of those learning processes by not loading. You hate to get out someday and you're trying to figure out how many acres you have left on a herbicide job or something you're doing, and you have to Google how many square feet are in an acre just to figure it out. But anyways, I really appreciated This summer, George, you gave us a little update on your Facebook page about how some of the loaders had done over the hard part of the summer. The
three failures.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was
yeah.
kind of interesting because you had a, there's a diverse group there. It wasn't three of a kind. It was all three of a different kind. And I just really appreciated that because it just emphasizes a lot of the points that have been made here that it just might not be for people. And to try and skip the process and go around is just...
No, and like the first one with the, you know, finishes his first full day of loading 57 days into the season when I let him come early in the season to start to see the deal because he'd never been around it. And it turns out that he realizes that we work with pesticides and doesn't like that. Because his father's a surgeon, or his brother's a surgeon, his father's a physician, and they have toxicology friends. I mean, we're crop dusters, aerial applicators.
Yeah.
It's what we do. And just because you're sitting in the cockpit doesn't mean that you're never going to fly through a pass, or you're never going to smell it, or you're never going to blow a load hose with the window down and never get any on you. You are not completely inoculated from it. Because you are sitting in the airplane. You can crash the airplane and the hopper can burst and you can get it on yourself and have to go throw yourself in a canal with a broken arm or something to get it off of you while you're waiting for emergency service personnel to arrive. It is a potential reality in our profession and you have to be mentally cool with that. Mm-hmm. And if you're not, you shouldn't be doing it.
That's correct.
Yeah. Anything you want to add?
Yeah, I was kind of switching gears, and you can tell me and re-roll it if you're going to get there, but we were talking about how do we know who to take on board as basically as a student or, you know, to break in. And so as difficult as aspiring ag pilots find it to get a seat, I think there's a whole host of operators and mentors that find it equally difficult to decide who to take on. And that's part, I think, that we don't really address. There's really no help for operators. You know, like I said, every operator has got a different personality. We're all completely different, accomplishing the same job. But it's hard to decide who should I invest in and who should I not, because in this day and age, the industry has gotten a reputation, you know, a fairly glorious reputation, that there's enough aspiring ag pilots that every single operator probably gets, you know, a call or two a month, depending on the season. And I think it's tough because right at the onset of your podcast, you were talking about how do you decide who you're going to break in. And, you know, George talked about his process, but ultimately, who are you going to let in the door? George just basically lays out a schedule for him and says, if you're here September 15th, you know, and you've done all these successfully, but personality-wise, you know, what are you really looking at? And it only struck me because Matt was talking about Marcus, and I had the same experience with Forrest. And that my criteria, like assuming your work ethic is solid and you do, you know, show up at 4 a.m. like you're supposed to and all those things that George discussed, is I'll give you a set of tasks for your own betterment. You know, and for Forrest's case, it was, I'm like, all right, go get this qual. Here's the books and here's your date that I need you to be completed by and we'll talk about it. And like that kid, he's more than I can handle. Like I have to pull the reins back on him constantly. Versus some others that I've had discussion with, it's a pretty easy filter system. I will give the same, you know, it's for their own betterment. Like, hey, here's the books. Look at this. We'll talk about it. You can see night and day versus an aspiring ag pilot or a kid or potential loader or whatever, where you have to give them the boot all the time. And that's my clear signal. If I have to motivate you or check on you or whatever, you know, versus sounds like Marcus and Forrest are the exact same. And that's just our easy examples. I mean, I have to pull the reins in on that guy constantly. Sometimes I have to say, hey, slow down. Mm-hmm. You know, we'll get to that. You're about 6 or 7 months from that. We'll get to it.
Yeah, we'll get there.
But it's always better to have to pump the brakes on someone than to have to put a boot in her ass.
Right.
That should be your very first clue that, you know, he's suited. And even earlier than that, I think kind of my key word, if I ever hear anybody say, I really, really want to be a crop duster, but that could mean anything. But I don't want to work an extra job. But I don't want to use my vacation time to come out and load. But I have to make more money because I got a wife and kids. But I can't leave my airline job. But, I mean, there's a whole list of those. And I have found if anybody says, well, I really want to load for you, but I really, really I want to be an ag pilot more than anything, but. So that's kind of a red flag verbiage for me.
Yeah, You can see that in people's actions. It's really what it's about. Anybody can talk.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. But when you throw the series of criteria in front of them, you know, you're looking to see some action. And if they delay or pussyfoot or try to cut corners or you just get radio silence, then you know that it's not really in them. Because this is a passion profession. This is not a quote-unquote or that profession. Yeah. Where they'll be like, I could be an ag pilot or I'll be a florist.
Yeah.
Okay? It's not like that. It's like if you have it in you to be an ag pilot, that's the ones that we're looking for. Because it takes so much effort and so much time to put into somebody to teach this, because this is an apprenticeship trade.
Yes.
That has to be known up front. Mm-hmm. I compare this to fine woodworking. Mm-hmm. And you may have been working at the lumber yard for 10 years. And you're like, I know all about 2x4s and plywood. But you decide you want to make cherry and teak cabinets for $1 million yachts. And you find one of the 10 guys in the world that does that. And you go to his shop and you say, hey, man, I know all about wood. I've been at a lumber yard for years. And he looks at the kid and goes, great. He reaches over in the corner of the shop and hands him the broom and says, sweep that floor for the first month and let's see if you don't screw that up. And then if you sweep the floor right, well, then maybe he gives you the planer. Yeah. Says, plane that over there. And then if you do right on the planer, then maybe he gives you the table saw. And if you do good on the table saw and the planer, maybe he gives you the router. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's the same process.
Same process.
It's just that people don't recognize that coming into this.
Yeah.
That this is how that's built on. And it takes a lot of time and a lot of money. And the last thing we want to do is put a lot of time and effort into a person and have them bail off 6 months into it.
Yeah.
So that's why we want to weed all that out up front with zero money put out on our part, zero, you know, like minimal effort, maybe not zero. I mean, I kind of put effort and time into people on day one.
Yeah.
When I start walking in the hangar yelling how many ounces are in a gallon.
Yeah.
What's the length of
I can't imagine what that hangar environment is like.
So,
how many ounces is
we can set
in a
up
gallon?
A there.
Wrong, yeah. Dirt bag.
Well, I mean, that's what they need to know, because
yeah.
They don't recognize that when we're calibrating airplanes to make sure that we make loads fit in fields that maybe the farmer didn't give us accurate acres and such, we're doing all this math while we're up in the turns with our hands busy. We're doing it in our heads while we're looking for traffic, while we're looking at the oil pressure gauge, while we're adjusting the GPS, while we're maybe looking at another airplane spraying an adjacent field so we don't have a midair. All of this stuff just has to be instinctual and in your head to truly be a professional applicator. And I think there's a real clear distinction between, do you want to be an ag pilot or do you want to be a professional applicator?
Here we go.
You yeah. Got something to say.
Well, yeah, along what George has said this quite well on his on the rookie page, and that is basically this is an application job. You are apprenticing to learn how to be an aerial applicator, and you can be Bob Hoover, Patty Wagstaff, Chuck Yeager, Skip Stewart, all rolled up into one big like ball of aeronautical awesomeness, but you can really suck as an aerial applicator. But you will, if you find someone that is an exceptional applicator, they by definition will be an outstanding pilot. And that's the deal, is anybody can fly an airplane. But whatever that grower has purchased to put out on their field needs to be applied in the proper way.
There needs to be a return on their investment.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
They're not paying you to go put on an air show.
And this business of we're just going to run over it and get it out of the airplane. That goes on.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not gonna sit here and say that it doesn't or pretend like it doesn't. It does.
Yeah.
And that we're that there we get back to the, you know, our past slogan, upon the performance of each rests the fate of all. And we're after growing up a new crop, if you will, of professional aerial applicators. There's a sense that I want Marcus at the 400 hour mark to be way better than I was when I had 400 hours. And that's my goal with him and you know, and whoever else I happen to teach, is I want them to be better than I was, to benefit from the experience. So I get, you know, I try to get introduced Marcus to all of my friends,
yep,
people that I know that I trust. So anyway,
and just to add on to something you said there, when you mentioned you want him to be better at 400 hours than you were at 400 hours, but on top of that, in the part of the whole reason I started this podcast is I would hope that people had a better learning experience starting out than I did, because unfortunately, when I got to travel this year, I met a lot of different pilots going to four different states, and we all talk about, you know, telling stories, how do we get started or whatever, and I just hear the same old, well, I just got thrown into it and started going, you know, and that's kind of the situation I was in when I started. Somebody asked me, they said, why did you quit your first job? And I said, because nobody wanted to mentor me. I was just told to fly. That was it. Not interested in that. But I would hope that as in, I don't want to hear that story in 30 years if I'm still doing this all the time. Well, I just started flying one day. I heard that a lot. So yeah. Anyways.
Well, I think we talked about it the last podcast you and I did. It's not a ding. It's just everybody in the industry that's flying is a pretty darn good pilot. You know, like I'd say across the board, or they wouldn't be doing this or they would die doing it.
Yep.
But not every ag pilot / ag operator is suited or has the temperament or wants to be a good teacher, a good instructor, or a good mentor. And a lot of times we as a group of operators or mentors, you know, we kind of think, well, I really want a mentor. Well, there's a lot of times you should just really continue to be a good ag operator.
Yeah.
You know, or a good ag pilot. There's not a calling for everyone to be a mentor. Not that it's a Jedi Knight skill, but it can definitely go askew when you think you're doing a kid a solid and you're really just kind of letting them hang. And that's how sometimes, you know, aspiring or new ag pilots will get themselves painted into a corner and sometimes fatally is not the correct direction. My personal thought is if you break somebody in, you own them. You own them and their mistakes for about a 5-year period. And the reason I say that is because if you look at any other highly complex skill, you could be whatever, nursing or trauma, any of the, you know, a lot of the military stuff, 5 years is considered the time period it takes you to go from the learning phase to competence in any sort of complex skill. And so that whole 5-year period, which coincidentally, you know, is what NAREF has their mentorship program going out to a 5-year pilot, is because all that time you're accomplishing the skill, but at the same time you're learning in increasingly difficult tasks and new experiences. So, I mean, that's why I take it personally, that if I take somebody on, I mean, I'm going to own them. And if they kill themselves or damage something, ultimately, I have to take responsibility for that. You know, that's not blowing smoke, but that's the truth. You know, and if somebody has a fatality or something like that, and it was judgment error, I want to say not ruling out mechanical, but if I put them in an airplane, I'm not 100% sure is going to perform for them. So, you know, mechanical, pilot error, any of that, I'm like, well, they were sweeping floors, as George said, when I got them. So if they don't have that knowledge or they make a bad decision, that means either my company culture is poor, my safety culture is poor, or I didn't take the time to describe those hazards to them or give them enough oversight. You know, and I certainly don't do it perfect, and none of us do, but as long as you strive to do that. But, I mean, you own them. Everybody out there who wants to be an ag pilot, just remember, it's on us. As George said, you know, I don't want to have to go explain to your widow, hey, I probably should have told him about that diagonal wire in the corner or, you know, any of those other hazards. So it's kind of a big responsibility for us too.
I hear a lot of stories, especially here now, talking to a couple guys already who have gone somewhere, you know, they've loaded for 3 years and nothing becomes of it. And, of course, I don't know everybody's story. There could be multiple reasons for that. But typically, when I'm talking to everybody, almost all the stories, there are no expectations set. And that's something we briefly touched on in our podcast episode. So my question to everybody at the table, whoever wants to go, is what are the expectations? So, yep, we'll go with George. So on September 15th,
what does that conversation about future expectations look like between you and your aspiring ag pilot?
Well, so it even starts earlier than that. I mean, it starts when they first show up and we first start to discuss it, when they're all wide-eyed and enamored and, you know, looking at yellow airplanes and sitting in the cockpit making airplane noises. I mean, if I have a potential for a position because we're going to add an airplane or something in the future, I either voice that, or if it is simply just a loading job for them to have a window into the industry with no opportunity of flying an ag plane, I will voice that. Or if there is an opportunity for them to come and prove themselves for a season, and then on September 16th, they might get a little tailwheel time in my scout or something like that. If they last the season, which, like the three failures, they're not flying any of my stuff. You want to help me and help my company, you'll get a little something above your paycheck. But you bail out on me in the middle of the season when I'm the 60 days where we're paying for the other 305 days that the bank still wants money and everybody still wants payroll. You're not flying any of my stuff. We're not pals, you know. You want to be pals, you can fly my stuff, because I'm not a flight school,
yep.
You know, and I only let pals fly my stuff. So we first start right there.
I'm actually going to use that term from now on.
And then
pals. We're not pals.
And then if
we're
they
bros and sisses.
We're bros and sisses.
That's right.
And so if we start there and they're agreeable to whichever of the situations I've laid out, then we move forward through the season. And then should they still be standing on September 16th, then we start to discuss, okay, if I'm going to give you the opportunity to break in. Because by then I know you. I know if you got it in you. I know if you have the personality to take what I'm going to shove down your throat over the next couple of years. And I know if I have the opportunity to allow you to have that position. Then we work into a very, very clearly laid out, written out 5-year commitment. And then we start working forward from there. And usually, at least with the last three that didn't have a whole lot of time, the first one had a lot of flight time when he arrived. The last three didn't. So I told them all, you need something with a tailwheel. There's your skin in the game. A flight school even gets paid for their time. Some of these guys show up and think that I'm the free-for-all flight school, and they're going to pull up to my 100 low-lead tank and go fly my airplane 8 hours a day, 7 days a week until they have their insurable amount of tailwheel time or total time or whatever. And because I've broken my last two guys straight into turbines, you do need a little more time than not.
Yeah.
You know, I'm looking for 700 to 800 total, with 300 to 400 tailwheel. And so we start right there. So if I say you show up in May and we say, okay, there may be an opportunity for you, or there isn't an opportunity for you, but hey, if you think you want to do this, you know, you're going to need to buy something to build time in. If in June they go out and come taxiing in a Pacer or a 170, well, now I know they're serious about it. And then, you know, they might burn some of my 100 low lead. I'm always cool. I'm always down for helping a little bit. But yeah. I'm not going to carry you. Nobody gave it to me.
Yeah.
So I'm not giving it to anybody else. So it's not my job. It's your parents' job. And if your parents don't own a flying service and you want to be an ag pilot, that's your problem.
Yeah.
And so basically we start right there with, are they taking, again, back to that, are they taking the tasks? So then if they've built their time, then we work on this agreement, and then it's very clearly laid out what I'm going to do and what they're going to do and for how long. And then we just simply start to check the boxes. And that's how it works. So there is no gray area. It's not, did he say go on or no go?
Yeah. And so I was talking to a couple gentlemen yesterday that were looking to get seats, and they were both guys who had probably 500 hours total time, 300 hours tailwheel, you know, just hammering to get a job. And
did they have a helmet and an applicator's license in any state?
I have no idea.
Those are the two questions to ask. Then you know if they're really hammering to get a job. Everybody wants to fly the planes.
Yeah.
Are you doing the book work? Are you spending the money on the equipment? That's the first two questions I ask. Oh, God, my hair's on fire. I really want to be ag pilot. I go, super. How many ounces are in a gallon? Do you own a helmet? And have you got a pesticide applicator's license in any state? Because that is what separates a pilot from an ag pilot. And if you, you know, if you talk to all the life coaches, one of the things that they say about, you know, successive improvement through life is, quote unquote, act as if you can. Well, two of the ways you can act as if you can be an ag pilot is buy yourself a helmet, get yourself a pesticide applicator's license. You can probably do all that for under $1,000.
You went a different direction than I was going, but I appreciate it still. That was good. Sometimes I get, and I was this way too, when I was discussing with operators that I wanted to work with, I didn't always feel like I was in a position to have any expectations, although I clearly, and I think that was from, I understood that whoever I was going to be working for was making the investment, and I was at the mercy of whatever they had to say, so I never, ever stated any expectations for myself. How do you guys feel about a young person that wants to break in, and what kind of expectations do you think that's fair for the young pilot to set in the relationship?
Well, take everything that George talked about of his expectations of somebody showing up for the first season. I don't think there's really a long discussion. I don't think it goes any longer than when George said, oh, you want to be an ag pilot? You're going to be a loader here, and we're not going to talk about flying until September. If all that pans out, right out the gate, I will say, and everyone knows it in the industry, there are operators who can be a little bit predatory. You know, it's a very small percentage, but like any great organization, there's always a 10%, you know, and there will be, and I think you maybe experienced it at some point, there's that 10% where they're going to promise you the moon, but they're not going to put a date on it. They're not going to put a bookend on it where you can do some planning. It's going to be, oh, we'll talk about it next season. We'll talk about it next season. I'm thinking about buying a piston and, you know, and aspiring ag pilots will keep following that carrot with nothing in sight. Well, you know, as George said, when you talk about any good life coach or anybody who's teaching you about goal-oriented performance, there always has to be a visual, you know, golden ring. There's always has to be something that you think you can attain, or you lose motivation, you lose passion, all those things. So looking at it from an aspiring ag pilot or a loader's perspective, my personal thing is I think you go into it with, I'm going to do this for a season, like George said, without having any expectations, because I don't know you. You don't know me. You can tell me you're the best loader ever, hardest working, you know, and then you end up being a sack of potatoes. So we can't really have that discussion until you get to his September 15th date.
Right.
Once that's done, you know, then I think that warrants a discussion. But provided you've held up your end of the bargain and you have performed everything to task, you know, that was expected of you or asked of you, and you think you now present yourself as a good candidate to be broken in, and your operator or mentor agrees, it's not unreasonable for you to say, hey, I just need to know what kind of timeline are we looking at. And it's fair, because if I say, well, it's going to take me 5 years to put you in an airplane, that's completely fair within, you know, your scope of just being another person. Yeah. Of saying, well, I can't do 5 years of loading. That's, you know, and that's entirely up to you. And that operator may, there are some operators say, hey, I need you to load for a season. Some may say 2 years, whatever the different flavors of the operations are. But I think it's fair if the operator lays out, this is what I want you to do after you've had that break in summer. It's also very reasonable for you to say, hey, what are we looking at, you know, time-wise? Now, the one caveat that Matt made me think of is, keep in mind that the very first operator you work for is very likely may not be the one that you end up flying for. And there's nothing wrong with that, because there are operators who will hire you like, hey, I really do need a loader. I don't need a loader who's going to turn into a pilot. I don't have the vacancy for it. But keep in mind, if you work for a, you know, a George Parker, a Matt Pete, a John Pugh, a Harley Curlis, any of those, and you do a good job, they will always place you with someone else who can and is willing to hire you on. I mean, I would love that, because that means someone else reputable that I trust in the industry has already done the vetting and the hard work, you know, for it. I mean, that's almost a gift. So don't get discouraged if your first operator just doesn't have a vacancy for you, or don't not work for a guy because he says, hey, I don't have a break-in airplane. I'm not planning on breaking anybody in. I would love to have you work for me. it can still be every bit as beneficial for both parties and still get you in industry likely on the same timeline. You know, yeah. It's not like you're going to start back at ground zero moving to another guy.
But go ahead.
I would relate my own first scenario, and I had a guy this summer that got in touch with me through the rookie page to sell his helmet because some expectation fell short of what was supposed to happen, and now he was going to go back and be a flight instructor and then move on to be whatever type of pilot. And I guess in my mind, I was kind of like, wow, you guys screwed only once and you're already wanting to get out? You don't have enough heart to do this.
Yeah.
So my personal scenario was, when I arrived to this, I had almost 4,000 hours, 1,500 turbine time, 1,500 tailwheel. I'd been flying seaplanes in British Columbia out of Seattle. I'd flown jumpers for 3,000 hours. So I'd worked airplanes. I had all the time that was needed. It wasn't like, you know, I have 350 hours with 50 tailwheel. You know, whoopty shit. And so I showed up with real time. I had bought myself a helmet. I had bought myself a flight suit. And I had taken all of the pesticide applicator tests for the state, for the operator I was going to first load for. And his promise to me verbally was, when I initially went to meet him, I actually got on an airliner, flew up to Northern California, rented a car, drove up there, met him face to face. Oh, yeah, we'd love to have you come load for us. I got this Cessna Ag truck. You can fly that Cessna Ag truck, get a little bit of time. You know, we'll kind of see how you do. And I said, okay. And so I'd been there for a couple of weeks, and I kind of let it go about a month. And I said, hey, you know, how about that Cessna Ag truck? Because, again, insuring me in a Cessna Ag truck with nearly 4,000 hours was not an issue, right? It might be for somebody with a fresh commercial, but it wasn't. And so his answer was, well, you know, we use that ag truck for mosquito abatement work, and it's almost mosquito abatement season, and God, that thing's got a really high time engine. I hate for that engine to quit and to lose that airplane just before the season. And I thought, well, that's reasonable. So I just said, okay, well, we'll wait till after that. And, you know, so I kept loading happily and smiling away, and we got to the end of the mosquito abatement season, and I was like, hey, how about flying that Cessna now? And he said, oh, well, God, now, well, you know, now it's been through the mosquito abatement season and it has even more hours on that engine. And I'd still really hate to have you wreck that thing and something happen to you. I just don't think we can do that. Now, he did let me fly his J3 Cub a little bit, but I mean, at that point, I don't, you know, there again, maybe to a guy with 300 hours, some J3 Cub time would add to the kitty of, you know, his credentials. I didn't need J3 Cub time. Yep. And so, but I guess, So that's my personal story of, you know, failed expectations. But a second segue story out of it is what I always point out to anybody that's coming into this from outside, is that it's a small business and it's about relationships. And so while I was there, although I didn't get to fly his Cessna, his pilot turned out to be my mentor, who is my friend to this day at 81 years old, 17 years into retirement. I still go visit him. And he actually let me fly his turbine thrush. This is when I was 23 years old. So I did a little rinsing out, got about 10 hours in his turbine thrush. So a failed expectation segued into a lifelong relationship with a very caring and knowledgeable mentor. He was a 30,000-hour ag pilot with 7,000 hours of nighttime, with 2,000 hours of night team flying, with 33 rice seasons. And so he was super experienced. I flew his airplane. That turned into an 8-year mentorship, although I never worked with him at an operation he was at. He was always there for me to reference over the telephone at any of the first bunch of seats that I took. If I had a problem, a question, anything, I would call him, and he would answer those questions for me, and he guided me through all of the application importance and the professionalism of being a true applicator, not a crop duster or an ag pilot. And 8 years later, I bought my first airplane, that same turbine thrush that I own today, 20-something 4 years later. I've owned that airplane for 17 years now, and that's the very first ag plane I ever flew when I was 23 years old. That's cool. And he's the one who gave me the 8 years of relationship and trust with him. He financed that airplane for me. So really what today is my business, I kind of owe to him because he helped me get into that airplane. So I guess I just point out that whether it's other loaders that are, become pilots and go off to other operations, or it's the pilots you loaded for, or neighboring operators, if you just go ahead and take the leap, even though it's the loader bitch position or whatever you want to derogatorily call it, it puts you in the business and it puts you out networking with other people. And if you're doing a good job and you're putting out the extra effort and you're being timely and people can see that you have the drive and the initiative, then they will help you henceforth, even if it wasn't your original plan.
Some people have asked, why is it that you can go and get all your ratings, so to speak, and, you know, be ready for the airlines or whatever. Yet I can come to an ag operation with, say, 1,000 hours and or whatever, and all
less.
Ratings or less. We just had a- and then why is it so? So I have all this time. I have this time and I have all these ratings, but yet I can't get anybody to look at me or give me a chance as readily as I would be in another section of aviation. Well, and the answer is, we're not flying, we're applying. And George has written extensively on that,
so
on the rookie page. But
you read Sarah Rodner's stuff, right? Mm-hmm. On that.
Okay, that's who we're talking
about. Yeah, but just a very quick blast, and George can probably kick it off, is she said it's impossible to get in the industry. And I think my response was, well, it's not impossible. I don't know one single good person that hasn't been offered a job, like, ever. Mm-hmm. You know, except for just a couple caveats like George was talking about where they end up going operator. But her thing was, well, you know, she wasn't qualified for it, and she was sort of denied at her couple attempts to get in the industry. So, you know, she got a couple other guys on board, and it was, the industry is so hard to get into that it's discouraging people from trying, you know, as a barrier to entry. And I think my comment was, I said, it's a pretty good filter. You know, I mean, it's not a formal designated filter, but it works. You generally get the people with the right attitude and the right aptitude in the job. I mean, mm-hmm. if it was easy, you know, everybody'd be wearing epaulets. And no kidding, I mean, that's why the airlines are filled with dudes, is because
yep.
it's easy. All you got to do is persevere and adhere to the published standard, and you're in.
Yep.
So I don't know how you want to address that, but that's probably – because there's a lot of that going on. It's impossible to get a job. It's so hard to get broken into the industry. And it's really not. While there may not be anything written, it's really not that hard.
Yeah.
No, it's so much easier now than it was 20-something. I mean, like I said, I had 4,000 hours of flying, had grown up around it, loaded the season, went and took the pesticide applicator license, bought the helmet, was all ready to go, and it still took me over 2 years to find a place to go. And I bounced from California to North Dakota and finally ended up in Northeast Mississippi.
Not only is it easier, but, I mean, people are starting out in some pretty wicked airplanes compared to, you know, my boss who flew 301s and Pawnees and his dad for years. I mean, he got a Turbine 400 for the last couple seasons he flew, and that was the greatest thing ever.
Oh, there's no question. But it goes back to what George said earlier. It's about relationships. If you are a decent human being and you understand networking, I've had that conversation with several young people, and that's what I tell them. It's get yourself out there. Make some contacts. If you come to these meetings, I will see to it that you get, you know, I will introduce you to some of my most trusted friends, people that I know that I've flown with. It's my family,
right?
Basically, because that's what it is. I mean, really and truly, that's the other aspect of this business, is that if you know, I'm a mechanic, and in the operations I've worked in, you work on each other's airplane. You know, at O'Brien's, we flew two airplanes to a field. So there are, you know, Charlie and I and Leon and whoever else. So you really and truly trust each other with your life. And if you work in that kind of environment, it doesn't take long to develop a strong bond with, you know, the people that you work with. And so you may get snippy with each other from time to time because of, you know, working 7 days a week, changing over twice a day, you know, daylight to dark. But, you know, everybody gets along and gets the job done.
Yeah, I think one issue in ag schools, they have a very distinct purpose in the industry. You know, they are an option. They're an avenue for people who may not, you know, think that they have a foothold or an understanding industry. They're an avenue. However, I think their existence at some points gives the impression that there's a quicker way to your first seat than loading and all the things we've talked about of learning the trade and all that. And sometimes that ends up being the point, is that there's no way to circumvent the experience it takes to get you in a seat. And right now, you'd have never told me 5 years ago that it would be commonplace to break guys in their first seat in a turbine. Forrest is doing it in an R502. You know, George is doing the same thing. So other guys, I mean, it's becoming commonplace now. We just have to up our game to prepare you to start out in a turbine.
Right. Which requires more on your part.
It requires a lot, yeah. It requires a lot more on the mentor.
Flight time and showing commitment. Because we can't, you know, it's one thing to go fly around in a Pawnee at 10 gallons an hour, and it's entirely another. You know, last spring, I let the latest break in after I paid for all of his trip down to Georgia to fly with Matt, go to the thrush factory, do everything to meet the insurance requirements, throw a $37,500 deductible in $100 bills bound out on the table for an entire summer, and then go watch him burn 50 gallons an hour doing slow turns and weaving his way across the field learning how to dry fly lines or perfect them. Matt had taught him, and he had flown his Pacer with my GPS in it first. That's part of the syllabus along the way. But you get so far into them that you need to know that they're truly committed to you.
Most definitely.
If you're going to reciprocate this, it's a relationship. It's a two-way street. It's not me, 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 me. How fast can I do this?
Yeah, there's also, I think there's also a misconception among some people that I go through this course and I'm ready to go.
Yeah.
And I get people to do, you know, get a turbine checkout. They come see me and they've been through a course and they can't, you know, they can't fly a line. And
they find out quickly what they don't know.
Right. And so I think, and that's okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's okay. But the what really concerns me though, is the attitude, I'm going to digress here, but our attitude and our approach is what's killing us.
Like literally killing us.
It is literally killing us.
Deader than fried chicken.
Yes. When I see a kid flying a 502A going underneath power lines, not in the process of application, but just doing it for the hell of it and flying between hangars, and then last year ends up falling out of a turn, going inverted in the ground, flat, that kid had it coming.
Yeah.
It really makes me mad.
Does not need to be made any more dangerous than it already is.
Right. That's correct. And so that, I mean, I'm sorry to, I don't mean, I'm not throwing, throwing stones or anything or whatever you want to call it, but that's just that's the reality of the situation, is that
that's
our attitude, our approach is what's killing us.
That's one story that we heard about because there was a fatality.
That's correct.
That's not the other. You know, say 300 guys broke in this season in turbines. I don't know. Whatever, just a number. We'll say 100. There's more than one by a long shot that's the experience that they're having. Yeah. It's just, I needed a pilot. I threw him into the airplane, and he went.
Right.
That's how it goes.
But I'm convinced that a young man that I worked with last year that ended up hitting a wire in a helicopter, you know, and got killed was not adequately supervised. And really just is a great guy.
There were a couple of helicopter fatalities like that this year. Where there's super low time pilots.
Yeah.
With nobody standing next to the field with the radio.
nothing.
Watching them, so, advising them.
I relay my own breaking experience at O'Brien's with Dwayne and Leon, and I was surrounded by, and Charlie, Frank, and whoever else. I was surrounded by people that had years of experience, tens of thousands of hours of doing this, practicing this profession. And so I was very fortunate to land where I did. And there was a constant, Dwayne said, it'll be 3 years before you're fully mission qualified, before I can hand you any type of map with whatever, and you know, you can go do it. But until then, we're going to kind of hold your hand.
Yeah.
Well, as George indicated, it's not a dangerous profession. And I say that, everybody says, it's the most dangerous flying job.
It's not.
It's not. It has some risks, you know, inherent with the type of application that we do, the type of flying we do. It is not a dangerous job. You know, you can still do a good job and mitigate just about all the risks, the overt risk out of the job. It's a very precise, you know, demanding, skill-laden way of flying, but it's not dangerous. That being said, we could go right down the list of fatalities over the last 10 years. I just got done going through that with Thrush, and you would be shocked at the percentage that are judgment error. You know, there always is, like, mechanical failure, wires you didn't see, something like that, but there's a ton of them that were judgment errors. And so where that plays in is when I'm looking at someone I want to break in, and, you know, we can use Forrest, for example, Marcus, for example, or whoever, is I really pay attention to your behavior. Now, I got it. You may be 25 or 26, and you're going to do stupid stuff, because I did too. But if you, no kidding, if you drive the company truck like a jackass 100 miles an hour, if you always engage in risky behavior, you know, aside from what you do as a 20-year-old or 22-year-old, you know, I can almost be reasonably assured that's probably what you're going to do in one of my airplanes. I mean, if you practice that all the time, it's a behavioral trait.
Right. Which is back to the whole, we don't talk about flying until we get through a season. Mm-hmm. We got to see what your personality is.
We got to be bros and sisses.
We got to be bros and sisses because,
I mean, seriously.
It's like Mike saying, you cannot tell a person if they can fly for you or even fly ag without knowing who they are. They show up with their hair on fire like, I'm definitely going to do this. I'm really good. Well, we don't know.
Yeah.
We got to observe you for a while.
Now, I've let a couple of the loaders that I've let fly the airplanes, you know, the Cubs, Germans, that kind of stuff, and I have said, hey, just understand this isn't a rental. And I let them know up front that, number one, it's not a rental, and number two, I'm paying attention to how you fly. I'll teach you everything that I want you to know, but I'm paying attention to how you fly. And if you treat my birds like a rental, or you're yanking them around pretending you're a crop duster when you're not, I can be reasonably assured that's how you're going to treat a revenue airplane. So, you know, this isn't, it's like I said, it's not a weekend rental. It's an ongoing interview. You just get to fly while you're doing it. And if any point during that interview period, and it may be a year, 2 years, you start displaying poor judgment, you know, I'm going to yank you out of the piston airplane so I don't ever have to yank you out of a turbine airplane. If I put you in a 502 or 402 or something like that, and I have to put you down because you're flying like a jackass, like, I have failed. It's not your fault as the pilot. I have failed because I've let you get that far
ahead,
knowing that that's acceptable.
But I think, you know, back to, like, some comments that were made on the page during that one little semi-blow-up thread about, you know, it's impossible to get into the industry. It's not impossible to get into the industry. We need pilots right now, but we need pilots who want to slow down, take a deep breath, take the proper steps to be professional applicators and to learn the trade, because making teak and cherry cabinets for million-dollar yachts is not ripping 2x4s to throw in the back of a pickup at Home Depot, and that's the difference. And those are the analogies that I would use. It's back to that apprenticeship thing.
Yes.
You've got to be willing to put the time in to learn the true trade and to learn to do it well, because each business's reputation rests on the performance of the pilot. That's we can lose customers over your performance.
Yeah.
If you don't do a good job, yeah, it can cost a business his customer.
I remember a situation.
Or her, Emily.
Yeah. I'm leaving that in there.
And I, along with just what on the back of what George just said, I remember distinctly a discussion that we had when I was breaking in. It was I ran short on some ryegrass and couldn't clean up some ends or something. Anyway, there was I made a mistake playing ryegrass, and I remember there was a couple of streaks in the field, and I remember Leon said, "Hey, I went back and fixed it." But I remember Leon said distinctly, "If I'd been a rice customer, we'd lost that customer, just like that."
Yeah,
you know, and so that was like, wow, you know, the reputation of that company rests on every single pass you're making in that field.
Yeah. I think some people don't – a lot of people who have never been around a business in their lifetime have been – or people who haven't been around others who manage a business have seen the books and things like that. They don't understand that aspect of everything. I was fortunate. My mother owned a hardware store that my grandparents built back in the 50s, and I lived at that place, and I understood – every single hardship that a business owner faces,
yep,
aerial application, hardware stores, home, well, maybe not Home Depot anymore, but I understood the risks and everything that can happen because of the failure of your, you know, a mistake that you make. And I agree. Yeah. People just don't have that insight. But it goes back to expectations and discussing that and explaining that, okay, if you can't stay on your line, I can't ever have you spray herbicide because if you streak up a field,
We're done.
You need to figure this out. I need to figure out how to teach you. Anyways.
Or if you get in a hurry,
yep,
and you run through a wire because you didn't recon the field properly, yep, you know, what does that actually cost? So there's, I mean, I've been a part of some other industries that were quote-unquote high risk. So I had a friend of mine that managed a very large tree care company, and he actually did an analysis. So if you choose to throw that or drop that limb without roping it down, and you smoke a freaking $10,000 patio table, you know, on a $2 million property, how long does it take that crew at that rate to make that money back?
Yep.
And it's on a, say, like a 10% margin. And he started doing that and educating all the people because he was getting new people in. And it makes a difference when people know.
We absolutely do want people and new people in the industry.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I think we probably don't say that enough. It is not a barrier. Nobody's trying to keep anybody out. We want people in the industry because everybody who flies for a living in this industry is passionate about it. It's a lifestyle. It's not a job. You know, for 99% of the pilots in the industry. So we want new people in the industry because that's the only way it's going to continue on. Yep. And as George said, you know, the industry is short of qualified pilots. So the party line is there is always availability and openings for good bros and sisses who want to work. I mean, there just always is. And to this day, I don't know one single good person who's walked around, beat the bush, trying to get a job. It was sincerely a good person with a good work ethic that hasn't gotten hired. Yep. It just doesn't happen.
It doesn't happen.
I hate to say this, but, you know, the cheap seats cry the loudest. So the ones that didn't want to work,
yeah,
you know, had issues, it's all political, they don't like me, you know, all these things down the road, I mean, you'll find out that they're just not suitable for the industry generally. And that's a hard fact. You know, nobody wants to say that, but good people get hired. People that aren't suited for the industry just – so on the outside of the circle. It's just the way it is.
They go somewhere else.
Yeah. So George has broken in, you said, two pilots now in the turbines?
Well, four total, two total. Into turbines. Okay. And I've helped break a third one into a turbine that went to work for a friend of mine. But
He
physically flew his airplane over to me, and I guided him.
So what is your process, your syllabus for taking these rookie, I want to be an ag pilot,
right,
to a turbine ag pilot without doing the piston time?
So for me, you know, the first thing is they show up and, you know, I want to be an ag pilot. And I always say, great, me too. We know I actually did because I'm still here 25 years later. We don't know if you truly do or not.
Yeah.
But that's that whole first season. And I just say, you're going to have to load for two seasons. The first one is no commitments, no nothing. You're going to take a small snapshot of your life, 3, 4, 5 months out of your life, and you're going to put the effort into showing up. You're going to collect a paycheck, and you're going to see if you like this. So we do the first season. We get to September 15th of the first year. And then I ask you, okay, are you sure you want to do this? Is that what you thought it was the last 3, 4, or 5 months of your life? If they say yes, then I say, okay, you need to build tailwheel time. They generally have to buy something to build tailwheel time in. That's their skin in the game. And so that, or I should say that adds to their skin in the game, because that first few months is kind of skin in the game as well. That's putting out some effort. They buy something to build tailwheel time in. They might burn my fuel, but they're going to buy their airplane so that, you know, they wreck their airplane. That's their problem.
Yeah.
Then we work on getting them to closer to 700 to 800 hours total time with 300 to 400 hours of tailwheel time. And then once they have that, then for the insurance, we have to go through to go to Matt's. Or at the time, for the first one, it was Flying Tigers when they were still in business. And they do a turbine transition course of 7.5 to 10 hours. I also sent the last one to the sim course at the Thrush Factory to kind of compound that. And then in the meantime, that second year they load, we take one of my entry-level GPSs, we place that in their tailwheel time builder. And that's part of them burning my 100 low lead. We go out and we ride with them a couple of times and let them start flying some lines. And then they just fly at fertilizer height. You know, I mean, it doesn't even matter. It can be 500 feet off the ground. They just work on figuring out what the light bar is, how to chase, how to follow the light bar, how to fly lines, and so that they're somewhat current and at least knowledgeable of the process of flying the GPS. And then once they go through Matt's deal and we get through the second year of loading, which is the first year technically of the 5-year agreement, it's 6 years total, 5 years on an agreement. The first year is that season of loading where there's no commitments from anybody other than I will give you a paycheck and you will show up on time every day till we get to September 15th or I tell you you're done. Then they come home and fly the airplane under my supervision with a radio standing on the ground around for like 25 hours. Just first 5 to 10 hours is just going out flying it around. They go and land at some of the other airports with big runways. And then again, we compound that by flying lines at fertilizer height for the remainder 15 hours or whatever. And then we start actually running through a dump sequence with liquid. So we do a full dump sequence. We work our way from like 100 gallons up towards 400 gallon loads of water. And we'll fly around with that a little bit and then allow them to dump it. We'll make sure that we land with loads. I land them with 100 gallons and I land them with 200 gallons so that we know that if we have a fan break or a ball valve break or whatever, that at least they could bring back a portion of the load without panicking about it, without wrecking the airplane. So we do all of that. Then we start to spray water for like another 10 to 15 hours. And we go through that process again, all under my observation with a radio. So, you know, back to what am I putting into this? I don't know what my time is worth. But I know I've spent many Sunday mornings when I could have been doing something else standing next to the field watching my break-ins work and telling them you're too high, you're too low, you know, do this, turn here, this is how you trim the edge. And so we go through that for another 15 to 20-ish hours, and then we'll put the spreader on and wait for fertilizer to begin. And on the last couple of hours of flying liquid, we begin to download and print their lines so that we can actually see what is their performance truly with the GPS. So once they're competent to fly the job, then we start some fertilizer jobs with me next to the field. I always watch like the first five jobs. Then like the next two or three always has one of my spotters with them to check edges. Are they getting the edges? Are they trimming the field, et cetera? When we do that, I'm usually back at the pad so we can, when they pull in and drop the doors, they're getting the load, I can jump up, look at the GPS, ask them if they have any questions, ask them how their calibration's going. We can discuss calibration and any other problems they might have. Then we do that for 25 hours. And then once we've flown about 25 hours of fertilizer and we have about, you know, 50 to 70 hours total in the airplane, then we'll put the booms on and we'll restart the process we did with dry with liquid. And we'll go and start on an easy liquid job, open and clear, with me next to the field personally. And I generally I'll have like one of my main loader guys back at the pad to help. But again, because they've loaded for two seasons, you know, they're kind of aware, they know what's going on. So that kind of helps things. And then I'll watch a couple of liquid jobs, again, probably like the first five jobs. I'll drive around, follow them, you know, you're too high, you're too low, you didn't get that edge, bring that back around, trim that pivot, et cetera. Watch the kid on the bicycle, watch the kid on the trampoline, whatever. And then I'll send the field spotter out with them again for another so many jobs and ensure that they're getting the edges and making sure that he's there to remind them, you know, there is a power line on this end. You do have a kid on a bicycle, you know, coming past on the road on the south end, et cetera, whatever might be going on. And then we let them just start to fly for a couple of hours. I probably let them fly another 5 or 10 jobs. And then we send the field spotter back out to make sure that they're not developing any bad habits in that period of time while they're flying on their own. And all we're trying to do is get them through the first season. Could be 250 hours, could be 400 hours, could be whatever. Generally, we don't push them. So when we get to the push of July, we either pull them out of the airplane for that period and have somebody that has experience come fly it for that month, or we just regulate how much they're doing. And then once we get through the first season, then we go to the second season where we kind of pick up where we left off, and we go ahead and work on refreshing everything in the spring, back to the dump series, landing with water, all of that stuff. We run through the spring safety training that I kind of have a company manual of, and then we will send them back out with the field spotter to do like the first five jobs. We let them go, and then now we're starting to, in the second season, increase the length of day that they fly and increase the complexity of field that they work. And constantly referencing with them, are you comfortable? How do you feel? Are you tired? Are there problems? Do you think I'm giving you too much? Do you think you can handle more? Yeah. And then by the end of the second season, they're doing pretty good. Then the third season is probably the most dangerous because that's less oversight on my part, and they're starting to feel confident as well.
Yep.
So we get through that one. Then I figure in their fourth season, fifth year, you know, fourth season of flying and sixth year total, that's where they're like, I can give them any map. They can go under wires. They can work next to town. They can start doing, we don't start herbicide until the second year of flying as well. And that's all wide open and easy herbicide, but no herbicide worked the first year. That's my particular syllabus to get you from, I want to be an ag pilot, not knowing anything about it, to, I can take any map and go out to the field, fly it from one side to the other with not too much chemical left in the hopper, nothing left short, no streaks, no problems, no complaints that you sprayed the homeowner next to the field. And you didn't chop your head off on the power line.
Totally changed my mind on breaking people in turbines. It's just a longer process. Mm-hmm. They have to understand that, you know. I mean, mm-hmm. if you've got a Pawnee, it's a much shorter, I mean, it's a shorter road to you flying an ag plane.
Yeah.
But in this day and age, let's be real, a Pawnee is not really an ag plane. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
you're not doing any work with it. An ag truck is barely an ag plane. You know, a yeah. piston ag cat is just barely, you're not making us any money. You're just practicing. So I would say the timeline is actually the same. You're just doing low performance ag time versus filling that gap with more and more training, building more hours so you can start out.
Yeah.
But then again, you don't start out hauling chili in a 402 or a 502 either. I mean, that's a very slow process.
Yeah. And it's not to say that we're starting somebody in a 402 this year, and he asked me what I thought about people starting in a turbine. And I guess my response was, well, the ag truck taught me how to respect an underpowered, low-performance ag plane. That doesn't mean that you have to do, like you said, it's not a rite of passage. You don't have to fly a piston airplane just to go get into a turbine. But when I say that I learned how to respect that loaded egg plane, the person with the right attitude will respect the turbine egg plane too. They don't have to do the piston time just to get the turbine time, if that makes any sense.
Well, let's be real. We're probably 5 years away from, you'd be hard pressed to find a piston airplane. Yeah. I mean, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
getting there.
With radial, you know, with 985s and 1340s going 45, 50 grand for an overhaul and not getting your money out of it, I highly doubt you're going to find one in 5 years with any sort of regularity.
Yeah. Well, and on the other side of the perspective, I mean, I know of one operation that is specifically using a Brave to break young pilots in, which, you know, is certainly responsible. But all they run other than that is a bunch of turbines. Mm-hmm. So they needed a portable fuel tank. They brought a portable fuel tank over. Turns out it still had a little bit of jet fuel on the bottom, and the kid ended up having the engine quit right off the end of the runway. Put it in the field. It was all fine and good.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's another thought. We're in a turbine world with a bunch of jet fuel. You interject one piston airplane for, you know, whatever reason to break a guy in, and then now you got fuel contamination issues potentially with, you know, maybe even you get, you know, inexperienced ground crew.
You know, that was actually John Pugh's point. I was sort of against breaking in a new guy in a turbine, and that was his point to me was, you know, if we go buy you know, a 1340 egg cat or a 301 or 401 or something like that, now we got to go buy a $10,000 Thunder Creek 100 low lead trailer, and we got to drag that around with another truck.
That's right.
Not including whatever the 150 grand it takes to buy that airplane that we're not going to get any return out of because it's a boat anchor and won't be able to sell it.
Yeah.
Like, so we might as well just take that whatever $75,000-$80,000 and just put it into preparation to put him in a turbine that we already have. Yeah. And we already have the facilities for. So when he broke it down to that, it made more sense.
Yeah. Instead of making that financial investment, you make the investment in time.
Yeah.
Well, we ended up getting kicked out of the room we were recording in, which was A-OK. Big shout out to the convention center for just letting me steal a room whenever it was available to record podcasts. Big thank you to George, Mike, and Matt for sitting down with us today and talking about this. It was an awesome discussion to be a part of. All these guys are very well spoken, and I just admire the knowledge they have and the manner in which they go about mentoring. So really appreciate you guys. Big shout out to the NAAA for the convention, because obviously, I mean, there's no better place to go find a bunch of ag aviation knowledge to tap into and talk about than the convention. So many great people, so many different backgrounds, and we're all in one place. The face-to-face interviews, I hope you guys enjoy them as much as I do, because I would much rather do this than over the phone. So thanks again, everybody, for listening. We will see you next time.